This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello and welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. This is July the 3rd, 2006. It's the Monday between the weekend and the 4th of July. I don't know what you're doing, but an awful lot of Americans have decided to make it a third, fourth holiday this year. And as we're celebrating our nation's birthday, there are a lot of folks who already are with friends and family celebrating in one way or another. So wherever you are, thanks for listening to the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about one of the interesting moral questions that has emerged in our time. With the ability, by technology and other means, to climb great mountains like Mount Everest, there come moral questions. And some of you know that in recent weeks, a man was allowed to die on Mount Everest when a team went right up to the summit passing him because they wanted to achieve that milestone, knowing that that they could have stopped to try to save the man's life, and they didn't. The question is one of basic moral context and moral relativism. Is there a different morality at 27,000 feet? That's what we're going to be talking about in just a few moments. But right now, a review of some of the issues in the news. University College Hospital in London has announced that its researchers are requesting permission from a government regulatory agency in the United Kingdom to screen for the sex of embryos in a couple that has a family history of autism. The Daily Mail of London is reporting that because male babies are far more likely to have autism than female babies, the use of this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis would allow families that have a history of autism to avoid having boys so that they could cut down on the chances of having a child with autism. According to Baptist Press, males are four times more likely to have autism than females, so the implantation of only female embryos would cut down significantly on the number of autistic children. Ben Mitchell, who is associate professor of bioethics at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in suburban Chicago, said, quote, if unborn children are being eliminated for a genetic disposition to autism, no one is safe. He went on to say, if genetic diagnosis for autism had been available 30 or 50 years ago, Silicon Valley might be empty. Dr. Mitchell added that it is believed that many of those who work in the computer software industry have a mild form of autism known as Asperger's syndrome. He went on to ask, does anyone think that Microsoft founder Bill Gates should have been eliminated as an embryo? As Dr. Mitchell, who also serves as a consultant for the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, said, the point is that we cannot make these judgments about who should live and who should die. Today, autism. Tomorrow, intelligence below 70. The next day, male pattern baldness. When will the madness stop? Well, folks, it's only really beginning, but this makes the point that if you have an ideal of perfection for humanity and you're not going to accept anything short of that perfection, then you will soon face the possibility through genetic testing to eliminate any embryo that doesn't meet your specifications. Now, at some point, maybe not an embryo, maybe a fetus. If not a fetus, maybe a young child. At Princeton University, Peter Singer, the bioethicist, suggests that children ought to be born into a world in which they have to prove their worthiness to be received as members of the human race. A representative of the British Council of Disabled People warned, and I read, screening out autism would breed a fear that anyone who is different in any way will not be accepted. It would create a society where only perfection is valued. Now, I find that very interesting as a concept because I'm not even sure what perfection is. I mean, we would all like, when our baby is born, for that baby to have 10 fingers and 10 toes. Dads, in particular, maybe want their boys to grow up with great athletic ability, want them to be tall and thin and muscular and fast and to have great eyesight. And whether you're a mom or a dad, you might have all kinds of expectations about your child. You might have expectations about beauty, expectations about intelligence, expectations about social ability or anything else. But are you saying that that is the only child you will accept? Because we are soon going to be in a consumer environment in which, in a world of radical reproductive technologies, we just may be given the choice. You can decide what kind of child you want, what kind of consumer product you want, what kind of profile of a fetus you want. And if you find this embryo or this fetus or this baby or this child acceptable, you may have it. But if you find it unacceptable, you may discard it. Now, it's also interesting that the Autism Society of America estimates that there are 1.5 million Americans with some form of autism. 1.5 million, that is huge. That is a major American city. With a growth rate of 10 to 17% each year, autism may be found in 4 million people in the United States within a decade. Now, we're not sure exactly how this takes place. Is it a biochemical thing, environmental? Is it genetic? We're not really sure. But I am sure that it's deadly dangerous to decide that you're going to start screening embryos, in this case, just male embryos, to be discarded because of the risk of autism. In California, there are a couple of big stories having to do with Christian schools. In the first case, a Christian school and six of its students is suing the University of California because of its admissions policies. You may recall we've talked about this on the program before. The University of California at Berkeley is setting down admission standards that is eliminating any course having to do with the sciences and potentially even literature and history that has distinctively Christian content. In other words, the University of California is not saying that a school is obligated to cover this material. It's saying that it can't cover other material, distinctively Christian material, and have that course accepted for admission standards. This makes no sense whatsoever, and this federal judge in Los Angeles is right to allow this lawsuit to proceed. I mean, after all, why can the University of California tell a local Christian school what it can't teach? It has every right, I would argue, to say, here's the admission standard, and if you're going to gain entrance into the University of California, you have to have classes in these areas that have taught these things and covered this material. That's entirely legitimate. But I don't believe that any state agency, including the University of California, has the right to say, but you can't also teach something else. That's absolute nonsense. We'll be watching that case as it goes through the courts, but there's also a very ominous case having to do with the fact that two girls were expelled by a Christian school in Riverside County, in the town of Waldemar, because they were perceived as being lesbian. Their parents sued, arguing that the Unruh law, or the Unruh Act in California, that bars discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, applies to Christian schools. In other words, they are arguing that schools, Christian schools in particular, cannot discipline children and students who are involved in a same-sex sexual relationship because that is a form of sexual discrimination. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the suit did not disclose the girl's sexual orientation, but said the school had violated the Unruh Act, which prohibits businesses from discriminating on the basis of a person's actual or perceived sexual orientation. The school argues that it is not a business and thus is exempt from the law. It also says its constitutional rights would override any state law. John McKay, an attorney for the school, said something very important I want you to hear. He said, and I quote, any implementation of the Unruh Act would contradict the stated position of the school that homosexuality is immoral. In other words, Mr. McKay, the attorney for this Christian school, says if freedom of religion means anything, it means the freedom of a Christian school to be Christian. And if an act of a non-discriminatory character comes in and says that a school, a Christian school, or a Christian church for that matter, can't discriminate on the basis of its own theological and biblical convictions on an issue of such importance, then religious liberty is effectively dead. Now, this case is not over. As a matter of fact, a judge is simply allowing the case to proceed. There is no verdict here. But the very fact that this case was considered to have enough merit to go on to trial ought to concern us. Because it says that at least this court considers the plausibility to be possible that it is indeed a violation of the Unruh Act for a Christian school to act on its Christian principles in taking action against children, in this case two students, who are apparently in some form of same-sex relationship. I don't know anything about the girls and their actual relationship. I do know that that is how it is reported in the press. And that is the basis of the complaint made by the parents. These girls' parents are suing on the basis of a sexual orientation claim. It would be very interesting to see how these two stories move along in the courts. Meanwhile, from Arkansas is a real stunner. The Arkansas Supreme Court has decided that the Arkansas federal, family agencies cannot discriminate against gay men and lesbians in terms of becoming foster parents. Now, a lot of you would be surprised. This isn't Oregon. It's not Connecticut, it's Arkansas. Not only that, it was a 7-0 decision by the state Supreme Court in Arkansas. The court ruled that the state's Child Welfare Agency Review Board, which had adopted a ban on homosexual foster parents in 1999, had, quote, improperly tried to regulate public morality, end quote. Now, that is really interesting. I have to wonder, how would the court decide that this agency had properly tried to regulate public morality? Now, they can't possibly say that this agency isn't responsible for giving attention to morality. Because, after all, you would not want a child placed with foster parents who had been bank robbers or embezzlers or anything else like that, or pornographers. I can't believe that the court would rule that this family agency is obligated to place children in the homes of people involved in such things. But for some reason, the state Supreme Court in Arkansas has decided that sexual activity is not a matter for regulation in terms of public morality. Now, I wonder where they got that idea. Maybe from the U.S. Supreme Court in the Lawrence v. Texas decision of 2003, a case which we said back then set a most dangerous precedent. And so it does. Folks, we're going to watch these things together because you have these two cases from California and now this case in Arkansas indicating that the whole issue of public morality and our conviction and issues of family such as adoption and foster care and all the rest, such as the ability of a Christian school to manage itself on Christian principles, these are all now matters for litigation. That can't be good news. But we'll stay tuned and keep you informed. We'll be right back. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
I guess it was about a year ago that my son Christopher and I really learned a lot about Mount Everest as he was working on a science project. And it was really interesting just to find out how the mountain was mapped and located and how its height was ascertained, its summit was defined, how people climbed the north face and the south face, and how, of course, in 1953, the world watched with awe as Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, his Sherpa guide, reached the summit of Mount Everest, the first human beings known to have reached it, probably, in all accounts, the first human beings ever to have reached it. And thus, their names went down in history, and since then, thousands of persons have tried to climb Mount Everest and K2, its neighboring peak, there in the high Himalayas. Talking about a height of over 27,000 feet. At about 10,000 feet and above, you enter what's known as the death zone. At that point, it is impossible for human beings to survive long without oxygen and protection. By the time you get within a few thousand feet of the summit, it is so cold, the winds are so fast, the situation is so dire, the air is so thin that persons go into delirium, hypoxia. They are robbed of all energy. Their body systems begin to slow down, and they will die. So one of the great, great risks of climbing Mount Everest is getting up and back without dying. And by the way, the coming down part tends to be where a lot of people get into trouble. And that was certainly the case with David Sharp, a man who got into trouble coming down, a British climber, 34 years old, who on May the 15th was found about 1,000 feet beneath the summit of Mount Everest. He had reached the summit and was coming down. He was found by a team, the central figure of which was Mark Inglis, a New Zealander, a man who is a double amputee and wanted to be the first double amputee to reach the summit of Mount Everest. And, by the way, he did. But they did so because they left this man to die. They did not try to bring him down the mountain. They instead ascertained, according to their own report, that he had no hope of survival, and they just went on. Now, by the way, just a few days later, there is a miracle rescue from almost the same area of the mountain. Australian climber Lincoln Hall was brought down from Everest's death zone by a group of other climbers, and they found him just 2 feet from a 10,000-foot drop. He was not dead, but sitting cross-legged in the process of changing his suit, his shirt. He had his down suit unzipped to the waist, his arms out of the sleeves, was wearing no hat, no gloves, no sunglasses. He had no oxygen mask, regulator, ice axe, oxygen, no sleeping bag, no mattress, no food, nor water bottle. He said to those who rescued him, "I imagine you're surprised to see me here." And they brought him down. And, of course, in the history of Mount Everest, there are any number of miracle survivals, and some of them very famous, including one man that survived the into thin air incident. That was made very famous in 1996 when there were several persons who died attempting the climb. Now, by the way, this has been a particularly deadly year on Mount Everest. At least 10 persons have died. And there were, we now think, more than 40 climbers who saw David Sharp as he was dying, and almost all of them continued to the summit without offering assistance. Sir Edmund Hillary has responded to this. Sir Edmund said it was horrifying that climbers would leave a dying man, and he would have abandoned his own pioneering climb in 1953 to save another life. Quote, "It was wrong if there was a man suffering altitude problems and he was huddled under a rock to just lift your hat, say good morning, and pass on by." He said human life is far more important than just getting to the top of a mountain. Now, New Zealand as a country, a fairly small country, and the New Zealanders are known as the Kiwis, they are involved in a deep moral debate over Mr. Inglis and his achievement at the cost, apparently, of allowing another man to die. Just how important is it, after all, to climb Mount Everest? Is it a noble thing in the first place to do this? In other words, we've now bought into an exploration, adventuresome kind of culture that says this kind of thrill-seeking, these extreme sports and all the rest are noble. But let's just remember that a lot of people are put at risk by these things, including those who would have to do a rescue, including those who have to be about all kinds of things, whether it's mountain climbing or rock climbing or deep sea diving or just about anything. We are in an interesting time where technology is allowing human beings to really press the envelope, as it said, of human endurance. But I'm far more interested in the morality of this. Now, when I first read this story, I was immediately impacted by it. I looked at it and I said, you know, here's a fascinating morality tale. A part of me was a little allergic to the whole question because it sounds a little bit like one of those values clarification exercises you have in the eighth grade, where liberal educators give you all these little scenarios and you're supposed to figure out what you would do in order to get in touch with your own inner values. Well, I think from what I can tell that Mark Inglis was in touch with his inner values. I just think they were the wrong values. You know, the problem with values clarification is that it simply describes what your values are. It implies that there's no objective right or wrong by which you measure your values. I'll tell you right up front, I think it's just objectively dead on wrong to leave a man to die so that you can go on to claim the summit of Mount Everest, even if it is in the name of double amputees everywhere. In other words, I think there are all kinds of rationalizations for this. But at the end of the day, is anything worth passing a dying man and allowing him to die? Now, let's come down from 27,000 feet to sea level or wherever your altitude may be. Do we make these kinds of decisions in other contexts all the time? It may not be a life or death decision, at least it may not be apparently so. But my guess is that most of us, at least partly, buy into some kind of moral relativism. And that's what I want us to explore today. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'll go ahead and ask this question. Would any of you support Mark Inglis in his decision to leave the dying man? I don't think there are many calls along those lines. That's not the main point of our conversation. But if you want to call and make that point, then we'll let you make that argument and try to figure out how you're going to get there. But if not, let me ask this question. Does this tell us anything about where we are in the devaluation of human life and in the artificial celebration of these newly invented human achievements, like reaching the summit of Mount Everest? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. As ethicists and theologians and philosophers have long known and affirmed, it is the questions at extremity that reveal the contours of the larger culture. And that's where we are right here. Very few of us are ever going to be at 27,000 feet making this decision. But in reality, here is my bottom line argument. Mark Inglis made that decision before he started climbing the mountain. In other words, there was a moral worldview that he had bought into before he ever put on his outfit and decided to start climbing Mount Everest. 877-893-8255 is the number. Let's go to Joseph, listening on XM-170, calling from Columbia Falls, Montana. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You're asking me, you know, if I agree with what he did. I don't at all. You know, like, he goes up there in the name of of double amputees wanting to be the first one and everything, but, you know, missing two limbs isn't his handicap. His handicap is you know, just an absolutely immoral mindset. You know, in my mind, what he did is no different than, you know, having a baby partially delivered and then jabbing a set of forceps in the back of its neck and sucking its brain out to kill it.
Well, now there's an interesting argument, Joseph. You're suggesting that maybe we have a different view of human life, at least some of us do, when it's unborn, preborn. Maybe the situation there isn't 27,000 feet, but just a matter of millimeters between being born and not yet born. That's a fascinating argument. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Is morality different at 27,000 feet than it is at sea level, or where you live, or where I live? Give me a call. This is going to be a good conversation, and we'll be right back.
The best of the Albert Mueller program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, welcome back to the Albert Mueller program. You know, this whole question of leaving a climber at about 1,000 feet under the summit of Mount Everest to die has become a raging controversy. And it's a raging controversy in places where some aspects of morality perhaps are not regularly discussed. For instance, in some of the journals about extreme sports, for instance, Juan Orzabal, who has climbed more of the world's highest peaks than anyone else, says, quote, solidarity doesn't exist on Mount Everest. He says when someone's in trouble, people just pass by without taking a quick look. In other words, this is just business as usual. This is a risk you take. That's what Gary Ball and others have said here. No, excuse me. It's another man who's quoted here saying that when Rob Hall and others rescued Gary Ball after he collapsed very high on K2, he couldn't walk. He was saved by the efforts of others. But this does not make heroism a duty, this man says. He said Rob Hall died on Everest when he refused to abandon a dying client. Nobody is saying that Inglis and the others had to sacrifice their own lives to save Sharp. Well, you see, that's just missing the point. No one said that he had to abandon his own life. It was that he needed to abandon his quest to climb the mountain. In other words, he didn't put his own life at risk. That's not even the issue here. He didn't want to put his achievement at risk. And I think that's the real issue here. Let's go to Kathy calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Go ahead, Kathy.
Albert, I think you've hit on something really crucial. There's so many areas of our lives that we put our own achievement above the morality of helping other people, even if they're not at the point of death. When Jesus said that we're to love our neighbors, he was asked, well, then, all right, who is my neighbor? And I think about, like, the what's happening in many African countries today with the AIDS crisis, the genocide, the starvation, as well as right here on our own shores with homelessness and people who are hurting. We can well ask, well, then, who is our neighbor and what is our responsibility to them?
You know, Kathy, there you go again, bringing the Bible into this. God bless you. And there you have the parable Jesus told of the Good Samaritan. And could there be a more incredible contrast between two responses? Here you have the Good Samaritan who loved his apparent political and ethnic enemy enough to care for him, to rescue him after robbers had set upon him and beaten him up, to get him medical care and to take care of his needs. When on the other hand, here's a man whose greatest quest in life appears to be to climb Mount Everest, who's willing to do that when at 1,000 feet he has to pass a man he knows is dying without attempting to save him. Kathy, let me ask you a question. When you think of this story on Mount Everest, are you shocked by this? Does this surprise you?
No, it really doesn't. I think it's human nature. I think we need to be more shocked. We need to wrestle with it more. I'm a scuba diver, and I wrestle with the issue of, well, should my family and I be spending money, spending the time that we do, taking the risks to go scuba diving? Yes, it's a fun sport we can do together, but should we put that money somewhere else to help people? And how far do you go to really make a difference in the world by helping people?
Yeah, now, boy, you just gave me a whole new line of questioning, though. I can't let you go yet, Kathy. When you say you're a scuba diver, let's just translate this from 27,000 feet up to a couple of hundred feet down. If you pass someone who's in trouble in a diving team, what's your assumed obligation? There must be some kind of moral code that divers would understand here. What would that be?
Absolutely. You'd always help someone who's in trouble. You'd help them out and give them oxygen. And I was just practicing with my two teenage daughters in a pool the other day because we felt like our skills were getting a little rusty in scuba diving. And we were practicing the buddy approach of if you would run out of air, which hopefully you never would, but being able to share air with somebody else and take care of them and get them safely up to the surface. And I found one of my teenage daughters was real good at that. The other one was kind of resistant to, no, let me do it my way. And finally, I tried to grab the regulator out of her mouth, and boy, that really made her mad. She bit down on it, and I thought, if we were in trouble, I would not want her getting mad at me and refusing to give me air just because I didn't do it her way, you know?
Wow. Well, let me tell you, I'm not about to argue with you on that one. It sounds like you've got the system down, and furthermore, it sounds like you start with a moral worldview that says we have an obligation to each other. I think that's what's missing here. I don't know how you pass a man without attempting to save his life. And by the way, the argument that he was just going to die anyway doesn't hold water when persons in very similar circumstances have been successfully rescued. Just how important is it to reach the summit of a mountain? You know, what kind of achievement is that, actually? I think that the symbolic value of that achievement is way overestimated. I remember the name of Sir Edmund Hillary, but to tell you the truth, I don't think most people in the world give a whole lot of attention to who else now is going to become the, 15,731st to climb some peak. But to do so at the expense of a human life, that to me is just so out of alignment with any sense of morality that it requires Christians to stand back and say, what has happened to our value of human life and what has happened to the moral conscience that would lead to such a thing? And why isn't there more unanimity and consensus that what he did was wrong? We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler program.
Very interesting story behind the story here. The controversy is over Mark Inglis, a New Zealander, a double amputee, who passed a dying man 1,000 feet short of his goal of climbing Mount Everest, and he went on and climbed and left the man to die. A huge controversy about that. That's why we're talking about it today. However, the LA Times, in an article entitled Morality on a Slippery Slope, has a very interesting background to this, and that is that Mr. Inglis, who's now 46, a former search and rescue mountaineer for Mount Cook National Park in New Zealand, was himself the subject of a spectacular rescue after spending 14 days in a cave on Mount Cook during a blizzard. He lost both lower legs, but with artificial legs, continued climbing with the ultimate dream of scaling Mount Everest. Now, that's very interesting, isn't it? So here you have a man who was himself saved in a spectacular rescue, and he passed a man dying 1,000 feet short of his own goal of climbing Mount Everest, and he went on. I do not think this is a complicated question. I am perplexed by all these newspapers, and I found some not only from the U.S. but around the world that seem to think this is a really murky, complicated moral issue. I don't think it's morally complicated. I think it takes an incredible inversion of values, an incredible confusion to believe that this is a complex issue. Let's go to Jim, listening on KFFF, calling from Ames, Iowa. Go ahead, Jim.
I had a just a comment about the debate of if it is devaluation of life. I think just the fact that we're debating it says that we have devalued life. And I think that also, I think more people are going to be saying to themselves, instead of look what he's done, a lot of double amputees are going to be saying, what has he done? I think that he's done a disservice to them and what he has done.
Yeah, I understand the first part of what you had to say there, especially the very fact that we have to have this conversation affirms that something huge has happened in our devaluation of human life. Jim, do you have any idea how we got there? I mean, as you're looking at this, just taking a view of the controversy over this man's death and the other man's climbing of Mount Everest, how do you think we got here?
Probably not just by not doing the things that we should be doing, following the Bible. And sometimes it is a slippery slope, and we can get places that we never thought we would be only without accountability and holding ourselves responsible for things that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what happens is that it's kind of an inch-by-inch, centimeter-by-centimeter devaluation. I don't think anyone gets up and says, look, we're just going to now claim some human lives is not worthy of protection, or we're going to claim that human life in context A, B, or C is not worthy of our attention. I don't think anyone would get up and say that so blatantly. Instead, I think it's just incremental. As persons just decide, look, I think we can redefine humanity this way. I think we can redefine our moral responsibility that way. And before you know it, you're leaving a man and going on to climb the summit. Thanks for your call, Jim. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to St. Simons Island, Georgia, where David's on the line. Go ahead, David.
Dr. Mueller, this issue is a very simple issue. It is found in a very simple biblical issue of Imago Deo. It is an act of murder. It is no different than if you walked up and shot the guy. Our society and our culture and the culture of this world has devalued because we have such a diminished view of God's greatness and his glory, and we have such an enhanced view of humanity, which is singularly unfounded and unrealistic.
Okay, follow that out just a little bit, that last part of what you were saying there, David. To trace that line of thinking out a little bit.
Well, if we are made in the image of God, then the image of God is what we need to focus on, not ourselves. And what we find when we do that, and Scripture is full of this, from Genesis right through Revelation, is that God is incredibly powerful, unbelievably good, unbelievably loving, and we are sinful, fallen people. We have no power, no intrinsic abilities. Everything that is, and I heard you speak on this one time, everything that is given to us has been given to us. It's extrinsic to us.
Yeah.
It is not something that we have inherently, intrinsically in our capability. We, all of us, all human beings, are made in God's image. And that is the richness of that, the beauty of that, in looking at God, would never let a human being walk by another human being. I mean, you know, the Good Samaritan example of this is minor compared to what has taken place with this man walking by another man for his own well-being,
yeah,
and some inane, yeah, accomplishment that means nothing. I mean, where does this fit, certainly from a scriptural and Christian perspective, on life? I mean, what, we are to cast our crowns in heaven, not on this earth. So what does it matter if you go to Everest?
Yeah, and I think, excuse me, I didn't mean to cut you off there, David. We've got to go into a break here in just a minute here, but I like where you were headed there. And what I immediately thought of, what David said that prompted the Bible verse in my mind, you know, what does it mean if a man should gain the summit of Mount Everest but lose his soul 1,000 feet short of that summit? I think that's a huge thing. We appreciate David's call. Very quickly, let's go to Sean calling from San Antonio, Texas. Go ahead, Sean.
Right, him. Hey, yeah, good morning. Good afternoon, I guess. This is Sean. Yeah, what strikes me is that this is like a clash of two cultures. If you want to talk from the Christian perspective, the Christian biblical, I believe in what the Bible says culture, and it meets this secular humanistic culture, which is what is dominating our you know, American culture right now. Secular humanistic, me, myself, and there's no absolutes, that kind of thing. And that's what this guy experienced at that certain level. He was not thinking of you know, if I lose my life, I'm closer to Christ and I'm in God. He doesn't think like that. He's thinking, I can save my life and let this guy, you know, let nature take its course, if you will.
That's, yeah, and Sean, I think you're right, and the situation's even worse than that, because this man's life wasn't really even at stake. The climber, it was his achievement, his goal that was at stake. Boy, you know, it would be an interesting discussion if we really honestly could talk about whether we are morally responsible to forfeit our own life for the sake of another. Greater love hath no man, said Christ, than that he lay down his life for another. But that's not even what's at stake here. It is this, and I like the way David put it. I think he said kind of meaningless. You know, it's a ridiculous goal when compared with a human life. You know, right now the New Zealand press is suggesting that Mark Inglis has been done wrong because he can't enjoy his accomplishment because of this moral controversy. Well, that's just wrong as an assessment of the whole situation. What a kind of achievement is this in the first place with the background of this man left for dead on Mount Everest?
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Well, welcome back. It has been a fascinating discussion. I enjoyed the calls, and I think they helped us to really clarify some of the issues. Number one, the bottom line issue is the dignity of every single human being, the sanctity of human life. And let's just nail that down for Christians. That is not determined by our own self-evaluation. That is determined by our Creator, who revealed to us that we are, alone of all creation, made in His image. Every single human being, man and woman, male and female, young, old, preborn, born, aged, infirm, whatever, is made in the image of God, bears the imago Dei, and is thus worthy of full respect. I think the second thing we've nailed down is that we do have an obligation to each other. And that obligation to each other is to rescue the one who is in trouble. And we're talking here about a clear case, a man 1,000 feet from the summit of Mount Everest dying and left to die. I think the third thing we've really looked at here is the ephemeral nature of human pride and human achievement. What does it matter that a man can claim to have climbed the summit of Mount Everest if in the meantime he has to know in his own heart, and now is known before the world, to have left a man to die 1,000 feet short of the summit? What about the argument that there is a different set of rules at 27,000 feet? That is made explicitly in many of these press reports, or people come back, some in the climbing community and others, saying, look, there's just a different set of rules up there. Well, let me put it this way. If there is any place in humanity, any place on the earth, that is, any place on this globe, where it is more morally permissible, morally allowable, to leave a man to die in order to claim some ephemeral human achievement, then human beings do not belong there. If there is any place on this planet where it is plausible that a human life can be expended in order that another can celebrate some kind of achievement like climbing a mountain, then human beings shouldn't be there. I think we know better than that. I think that's why even the secular media has focused on this as a story. They have not been able to dismiss it as something that is morally irrelevant, because we know, and we really know we know, that there's more to it than that. On this program, we try to take the issues of the day, the questions of our age, and come back at them asking the basic question, how should a Christian think about these things? And when it comes to morality at 27,000 feet, Christians have to start out by saying, we've got to affirm the necessity of a moral worldview before you start climbing that mountain. It may be the case, it is almost assuredly the case, that in moments and points of extremity, just like that at the top of Mount Everest, we really find out what we're made of, and we really find out what our morality is. And that can be scary. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.